I don't screech.
Well, you do.
It's a perfectly pitched.
You're a little screechy. You get excitable.
You do.
Okay. I say excitable. Really, it's just mean-spirited and nasty.
Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and the odd bit of idle gossip. I'm one of your hosts, Ian Mond. To my left is the lovely Kirsten McDermott. And to my right is Jay Richardson's son.
Hello, mister.
No, I'm going to give you time to say hello.
Okay.
What do you say, box cutters? How do you introduce yourself?
Well, it's usually my name. So we've already gone, you know, off,
so ruined
off piece.
It. Yeah. So, yeah, I stuffed that up because that was really carefully planned and I've ruined it. Oh, well. So why, John, did you decide to come on The Writer and the Critic? I mean, controversial move, I would have thought.
I think it's because you asked me.
Yeah.
And I'm quite needy.
Yeah, okay. That's a fair comment. And Kirsten, you were for it. Have you said hello?
You wouldn't let me say hello.
Well, say hello now. You just spilled water everywhere.
I did spill nothing anyway.
Okay, good,
just
nice.
A toaster.
So, we've got you on, which is great.
Can I say hello?
Hi.
Hello.
Yeah, okay.
Did you actually say who I was?
John Richards.
Okay.
I said Jay Richardson's sons, which was my joke.
It got confusing.
Did it? You're John Richards. You're one of the guys from Box Cutters. You're doing some TV show that may come out sometime next year, prior to the Mayan Holocaust.
I mean, you think my TV show is just some really weird art prank I've been pulling off for the last 5 years. You know, let's get interviewed about that show that no one's seen.
You do realise of the couple of hundred listeners that we have, and it is about a couple of hundred, they've all heard more of you than they've heard of us. I mean, most of them would be Box Cutter fans, except for the odd American. Actually, you've probably got plenty of American fans, don't you?
We've got some Americans.
Because you're adorable and amazing.
I'm adorable and amazing.
Who said
amazing
that?
And adorable. Seattle Bay Press.
Oh, that's right. The adorable. And someone from Twitter said I had to say hello from you, but I forgot who it was. Stephanie, someone or other.
That's helpful.
Right. That's very useful.
Yeah. Sure.
Yeah.
Hyphenated name. Yeah.
Yeah. I know who that is.
Really?
Yeah.
Are you lying?
No, Stephanie BG from Perth.
Yeah, that's it, Stephanie BG from Perth. She said, say hi to John Richards and sons, because he's cute and adorable. No, she didn't say that bit, but
amazing.
She said something not. Yeah,
amazing.
And adorable.
Yeah. So you know her.
It was Saddle Gay Press calls you amazing and adorable. You know. I know of Stephanie BG's work from Perth.
Yeah, it's bad, because I didn't know her. Actually, I was following her on Twitter. I just press follow on things.
No, you're useless.
I know.
You're useless.
If this was Box Cutters, we'd be calling
you. Did you just follow everyone who follows you?
Yes. No, except for the porn sites and the people trying to sell things.
But you follow them first.
No. Shut up.
I was going to say, if this was Box Cutters, I would have edited about 2 minutes out of this by now. Because that's my new gig, is just getting to edit the episode.
Is that what you're doing
now?
Yeah,
we had it now, because we had a terrible stuff up where we managed to put like a episode that had half the things missing in it because we didn't bother to check, and then we replaced it with another one that also was wrong, and so now we edited it. Also lets me make it a bit shorter.
Because as I was telling you before, I'm still at September 2010 with Box Cutters, so I'm well behind. You know what's great about the show? The news is old, obviously. It's a year and a half old, well, a year and 3 months, and yet still feels fresh. I think, really? Kerry Stokes? Channel 7? I had no idea.
Think of all the things that are going to happen that are going to surprise you.
Yeah, I know. Oh my God, really?
People will die. Shows will get made.
Yeah, because like 2011 was the floods in Brisbane, wasn't it? So you haven't even got to there yet.
That hasn't happened. Yeah,
in my world, in my Box Cutters world, there's been no floods. I don't know if you talk about it on the show. You probably do.
I don't think we do. I don't think how it would show up.
Well, you know, Box Cutters is actually kind of magic in a bad way. It's black magic.
In what way?
Well, I was listening to, I think it might have even just been last week's episode, and you weren't talking about Studio 60. But it just came up in conversation. Mm-hmm. Yep. And when you were talking about shows that kind of started well and then dropped off.
It's an abandoning shows. And what point do you give up on a show?
And we're watching Studio 60 at the moment. We kind of started and I'm listening to the podcast thinking, really? This drops off? But it's been kind of good. And that night.
Oh, no.
We watched the episode where it's that horrible flashback episode.
We broke it for you.
And I just looked at my husband and went, this isn't just me, is it? Because I listen to Box Cutters. This is actually bad. And he said, yeah, this is bad. And we watched two more. It's like, the show's gone now. It is dead to us.
Oh, see, now I feel terrible that we stomped on your dream.
But it was just a weird coincidence. And I do wonder if I hadn't listened to that Box Cutters episode, would it still be a good show? I don't think so. That was a terrible episode. I can't believe that was the same show.
Is that your anecdote for the episode?
Oh, shut up.
Oh, no, I found it really interesting, but I wanted to ask him questions, not hear what your stupid stories. No, I'm sorry. I know. You, oh.
You are the worst couple ever. I don't know why you guys got married.
My wife asked the same question. And my polygamous friend lawyer. Anyway, so what I want to ask you was, have you actually been interviewed on the reason you joined Box Cutters and all that? Have you actually, has it been much, have you had any post outside Box Cutter interviews?
We've done a few interviews about Box Cutters as a form, you know, as a podcast form.
But any questions directed at you?
No,
I'm gonna,
no.
Okay, good.
Really.
So if I ask questions, how did you join Box Cutters? People aren't going to groan and go, well, he's answered that fucking
question. No, no, no.
Times.
And again, it's a terrible, it's because they asked me thing. It's a thing I went on as a guest to talk about Outland, my art project. Yeah, concept.
Yeah.
Pretending I have a TV show about a gay science fiction fan club. I mean, that's the joke. Clearly, there's no TV show about a gay science fiction fan club.
Make
no,
one, that.
No one's going to fund that.
Would they show that on the ABC?
I know, it'd be crazy claiming that the taxpayers' dollars are going to be put to a show with no fists together. And that was 2008, I think, I went on to podcast to discuss that. I wanted to talk about what it's like to have a show in development. And then I stuck around for the next...
So Outland is connected to all of this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, it was. That's why I went on to Box Cutters. And then I got asked to come back.
It's Lovecraftian.
Three
tentacles everywhere.
It does. And that's why I did the radio show as well on Joy. I wrote the blog called the Outland Institute for a bit, and then that became a radio show on Joy because I liked it, and it's Box Cutters. Oh, everything feeds and everything else. Nothing pays anything. It's terrible.
Yeah, well, you're not expecting to get paid for this, are you?
Yeah. Isn't that, didn't we negotiate that?
Didn't you tell him that it's just kittens?
Yeah.
Wow, I read three books for nothing.
Terrible. That's brilliant.
Only read to be paid. That's really sad.
So basically, since 2006, Outland has ruled my life, and rumor has it February 2012 it will actually be on.
February 2012. So 6 years from the
the short film.
That was in 2006.
Yes.
The first seed inkling that you had was
2005. We wrote the short film.
Okay.
And we sent it in.
Very first time you had the idea, was that on a toilet in 2004?
No, that was 2005. So that was a cup of coffee. That was one of those coffee things with Adam, and I said you should have a. You know, you should have a thing. You should have a vehicle. That's what they call them. A vehicle for you. And when you should play a wacky best friend. Which Adam and I both knew. He should always play the best friend. He shouldn't be playing the lead. He should always play the best friend. And he had this amazing, complicated and difficult idea. And I said, that sounds amazingly complicated and difficult. What else? He went, gay science fiction fans? Let's do that.
Yay!
And that was pretty much, we wrote it really quickly. It was and we wrote it as a sitcom pilot. We sent it to ABC. They said no. So we made a short film of it, went into queer film festivals around the world, sent that to the ABC. They went, oh, this looks interesting. Word for word, the same thing they'd already rejected. But, you know, and then, then it got developed from there. And the development time is where most of the time was. And I always have this theory that our project got made by momentum. Like, I don't think anyone was necessarily... it got like a tiny push somewhere in 2006.
Yeah.
And no one ever remembered to get out in front of it and stop it. So it just, 5 years later, crossed over that line.
Yes. I remember seeing either the short film or the pilot years and years ago, and I can't even remember. It was on VHS. That's
really?
Yeah, wow. Or maybe someone had burnt it to a DVD.
Are you making this isn't
no,
right? Don't
I just,
you making
I can't,
up?
I just
I'm
can't remember
it
where
VCD
I saw it. Maybe
it was at
a convention. Maybe it was shown in a the film stream at a convention
cons,
somewhere.
It
might have been
MSFC played it. Yeah, so you know.
So I do remember vaguely years and years ago seeing it, and I'd quite like it. I've been waiting ever since for this show.
It's weird because the first episode is pretty much a remake of it, but yeah, with some money. And it's just that kind of odd thing. If anyone who's familiar with the short film, to go, this is weird. I know half this dialogue. It's strange.
No, we have some impressionable 25-year-olds who listen to this show. Mm-hmm. I'm making that up. But if we did, would you tell them not to bother writing a TV show because it's about 6-7 years of your life? And if you worked out per hour and how much you got paid?
Oh yeah, no, that's all dreadful. But it was. I mentioned I've just flown in from Sydney, and boy, are my arms tired. And last night I was at
what a gag.
I was at the ABC 2012 launch, in which clips of my show were played in the ads, which is the first time I went, oh, look, they're actually showing.
So in January, when they do that sort of shit, we'll see clips of Outland for the first time.
You'll see clips of dancing. They seem to have taken this one dance sequence from episode 5, and that's pretty much it. Toby Truslove said, don't know why you bothered running jugs. Could have just been 25 minutes of dancing. But they were doing the big push, and I was talking to Frank Woodley, because he's got his show Woodley coming out this year, and to Judith Lucy as well, just had her show on, and they were both giving
me some more names.
The world's as we were standing next to Andrew Denton and that guy from Media Watch,
Jonathan Holmes.
Yeah,
I love him. Anyway, keep going.
And I met the host of Giggle and Hoot.
Oh, Jimmy Giggle! You Jimmy Giggle! Oh my god, my wife is doing her pants right now.
You know how I was talking before the show about the high pitched voice?
I don't squeal.
That was the
hilarious thing, though, was because I've forgotten the guy's name and I just remember the name of the show, but that's the same reaction the other person I told when I met the guy from Giggle and Hoot. She also did that.
Well, my son watches it avidly. He's 17 months and he, hoot, hoot, Jimmy. Well, no, he says giggle. Anyway, but a lot of women are hot for him. Yeah. And he wears Jimmy in Hoot pajamas, was he in the bright yellow pajamas?
He wasn't, no, he was in a suit. He's actually quite gorgeous in real life, whereas in the clips they played, I wouldn't have done him in the pajamas.
No, because he's acting like an idiot.
And he was talking to an owl.
To an owl, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That was actually followed, though. That was the ad for ABC 3 for kids or whatever it is, followed by the ABC News 24 promo. And we were saying they should have done the two promos the same way.
Yeah.
Because it was all like, hey, owl, do you know what's coming up on ABC 3? Is it a new series of kids? And we're going, why didn't they do the news one the same way? Do you know what's coming up on News 24?
Is it an investigation into the international crisis and the monetary fund?
No. Anyway, I was going to say, but so Frank and
oh yeah, let's go back to the story.
My mates Frank and Judith. We're giving you this these horrendous unpep talks about no matter what you do, the next one's just as hard.
Lovely.
It's going to be terrible. Everything ends in failure and death.
But with someone
thanks,
like
Frank Woodley,
you probably don't know the answer to this, but someone like Judith Lucy, she's made a career out of it. I mean, she doesn't work at 7-Eleven. This is what she does, isn't it?
Well, it is. But even then, it's at the end of each project. There's no kind of good.
So the dog cue beckons. I mean, sounds really depressing.
No, pretty much. Yeah. No. It was actually surprisingly depressing last night. Sydney Barr and because Frank Woodley is a genius and Judith's a genius. And they're brilliant comedians and they're going. Yeah, we've got no security. There's no safety in any of this. It's just
and it's not. You don't earn enough money out of it to save it. Like
no, not really. It's
welcome to the arts in Australia.
It's like if you were doing a series every year, you'd be on a reasonable wage, and even then. Reasonable, you wouldn't be top end or anything, but you'd be. But because one series takes usually 2 to 3 years, or in my case, 17, it's just that thing of, but the hourly wage is not good.
Well, you maybe can pick up Holder now they've dropped Kyle Sanderlands.
One can always dream.
What happened to Kyle Sanderlands?
$2 million going begging right there.
Did Kyle Sanderlands leave Joy FM?
No, Holden
dumped him, Why is he still on? How does he still get radio? And don't give me the ratings argument. I don't want to hear it.
He may not anymore because Holden and the good guys and I think Telstra, they've all kind of bailed over this latest bit of dickery. So.
Well, I hope whatever FM station he is. But is it Today FM? Is that it?
Sydney
rubbish.
It's something on Austereo.
It's weird in Sydney, though, that things like those, I mean, he's not the one, but the shock jocks, the kind of Alan Jones and all that kind of, the rabid, insane right-wing nonsense. Is considered mainstream entertainment, which I find really weird. Like, it'll be playing in shops, where you go, really, that wouldn't be acceptable in Melbourne. Like, you would think, no, that this is more for sitting at home in a bunker and no one else can hear you.
Well, Steve Price went to Sydney, and we thought he was a right-wing rabid person in Melbourne. He went to Sydney and he was considered moderate.
Yeah.
So he came back to Melbourne.
Yeah.
Because, he just couldn't get,
Can't compete with Alan Jones.
Well, you can't. Because he's mad.
Yeah.
Insane.
I think you should get Alan Jones and Kyle Sanderland, put them in a room together and lock the door until one of them eats the other one.
Two men enter, one man leaves.
That would be awesome.
So basically what we've learned tonight is podcasting, you get no money, so you get no money for the books that you read, and also don't get involved in any sort of creative stuff.
I think basically don't dream. That's what we're saying.
Don't dream.
Don't dream. Don't dare to hope.
I think you can dream. I think you just realise they just need to stay dreams.
But someone like Chris Lilly gets money.
Try to turn them into reality.
Chris Lilly can make a buck out of it.
A hobby. Yeah, I mean, I guess. I don't know.
Do you walk around and ask people how much they're earning? Did you go up to Denton and say, as a brood of films or whatever thing
you're about? Such a Jew.
I am. It's true, though.
I think that's your cue.
Come on. What?
To ask John.
Oh, who the best Jew he's worked with on podcasting is? Me and Josh, come on.
What is this thing with you and Josh?
Look, Josh and I, when we're at university, we look reasonably similar. I'm better looking, but we're still reasonably similar. His eyes are more deeper set, you know, so his bags come out a bit more. I really shouldn't say this, it's terrible. But anyway, he was the funny one, the funny Jew. I was funnier, but I think at university he brought...
There was only room for one funny Jew.
There was only, and Monash especially, a small campus that it is.
That niche is filled.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, it's funny. I'm pretty sure his brother auditioned me for theatre sports or something at Monash and I didn't get in. I wasn't funny enough for his brother. It's a family thing. The canals are against me.
You've been carrying this, haven't you?
I find this amazing.
Well, I don't know. I don't know what happened. I may have got sick on the day or something.
Oh, I got sick on the day.
Angry. Did you get ranty?
Yeah.
Right. You do get ranty.
Yeah, I didn't rant as much at university in those days. You know, I was more subdued and... Really, it's not about me, it's about Josh. And I'm just saying that you've worked with him for now, 3 years? And I'm just the 10 minutes you've been here, and it's been a bit more than that, you're getting better quality, better questions. Well, he doesn't even interview you. You just come on and you're except for that first one.
No. Weirdly, he does occasionally interview me. It's really weird. Well, yeah, we're at Continuum, and we ended up doing a panel together, and then one where he interviewed me about Outland.
Yeah.
My avant-garde art project.
Yeah, but that's at a convention somewhere where, 45 people in the audience are... No, for a few.
Let it go.
I can't.
Let it go.
Look, there are only two Jews in the podcasting world, me and Josh.
You actually,
are you sure about that?
that seems unlikely.
Listeners, right in.
I also love the fact that, your listeners who don't know box cutters have just been bewildered by the last 15 minutes of questions.
Yeah, well... It's like, well, we'll have a link to Box Cutters and they can catch up with the 271 episodes you've done. So
284.5, I think, plus specials.
It's plus specials, yeah.
There's a lot of them.
Shit, I mean, and you guys are still going. And not to get too depressing, but is Box Cutters ever going to come to an end? Not that I wanted to.
Oh, my God.
No, it's a perfectly fair question to ask.
It's a horrible question.
I think when we naturally reach the end of the story we're telling.
That's a perfectly fair answer.
The end of television?
Yeah. When we get to it. Well, that's it. We've done everything.
Right, okay.
We've done them all.
They're not making any more shows.
All the shows are done.
All right. Well, look, we've got three books to get through. Do we want to talk about them?
Let's give them a go.
We've got a couple of news. We've got one.
Well,
we don't do news on this show.
We don't do news.
You do on your show, and it's brilliant, of course. Do you still do the little intro? Because, again, I'm 15 months behind. You might have changed the little news intro.
Yeah.
You see that? Yeah, well, we don't have that ability because Kirsten's not smart enough to put little...
Basically, I think we made some carts in 2006 and we're just going to keep using them until we break.
What? Do you think we should do... Well, we don't do news, so there's no need to put in a cart. Apparently, that's like a big tape you put into a thing and it makes a noise. Oh, don't give me the... It's audio! Fucking hell. People can't see you glare at me.
Kirsten is
they can hear the glare.
They really can. Your glares are so visual when you listen to the podcast. It's amazing.
You give the news.
Well, there is no news, except just to say that I was at the World Fantasy Convention last month.
Where you were badly treated.
Oh, well, no, we're not talking about that.
Uh-huh.
Oh, don't have to edit that out.
No, you don't.
Be bad, bad behaviour. No, I just wanted to say...
What?
I was not badly treated. There was an idiot at the convention. But
it's more this weird fanish thing there. I mean, look, yes, the whole world is 12-year-old girls. Let's just, we know that's true. And every group is 12-year-old girls, no matter what they happen to look like or how old they are or, what gender or how they behave. Really, when it boils down to everyone's a 12-year-old girl.
What happened?
Pulling someone's hair and then running away and hiding behind the sheds and having a diary and not telling Sue when she's crying. But the fact that this getting back into the science fiction sort of fandom thing recently after being away for so long, and it's full of these stories about people being mean to other people at conventions.
This guy was harassing you a group of other girls. Well, but look, you're right. We won't talk about it.
Anyway,
I think Galactic Suburbia covered it.
They did, exactly. Anyway, did they?
I don't think they did.
I listened to that one.
No? Anyway. Well, maybe they haven't. Maybe they will.
Anyway, I just wanted to say
yes,
the World Fantasy Awards were announced at the World Fantasy Convention, surprisingly.
Yes.
I know, I was amazed.
Contravention of all their rules.
And congratulations to all the winners, and that's lovely, but I just want to just do a special call out to Nnedi Okorafor, whose novel Who Fears Death won the best novel.
And that's the book we said should have been on the Hugo list, but wasn't.
Which is a book we reviewed on Writer and the Critic, and we both love to death. So congratulations, Nnedi. We're really, really happy that you won. And also, really lovely, Elisa Krasnstein from Twelfth Planet Press won the non-professional Special Award category for her press.
They actually made her say that herself on Galactic Suburbia.
Yeah.
They weren't
yeah.
willing to. No, it was hilarious. The other two, like yes. Tansy, they wouldn't.
They made her say it.
They made her actually announce it herself.
You know how I'm there going, 13. You know how I'm 14 months behind on box cutters? Yeah. Up to date with Galactic Suburbia.
Yeah, well, I think that says a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Very much. Yeah.
So congratulations to Elisa, and it was wonderful to actually be there and watch her rather shocked walk up to the stage. She was quite overwhelmed. So congratulations, and congratulations to all the winners. We're not going to go through them because we don't.
Can I ask you, this is not a rude question about Elisa. No, it's not. No, I'm not going to talk about the molester guy.
So I always get worried when you say, can I ask you this?
I just want to,
when I was talking about girls, I was thinking, like, in the way that Elisa and 12th Planet always gets this crap coming at them for just being good.
No, well, I wasn't going to ask about that either, because they are good. But I was going to ask you, because I haven't seen a Lovecraft statue. You've now seen one.
Oh, yeah.
How ugly really is it?
Well,
because the statue is a face of Lovecraft, HP.
It's
his face, but it's an elongated sort of big beaky. Yeah.
Well, he did have rather a long face and a beaky nose. It's like if you got HP Lovecraft and chopped off his head and shrunk it and then kind of melted it. That's what you get.
Worse. That's an award. That's the award.
I don't know. It doesn't sound as pretty as a Kronos award.
I was going to do that and say Kronos award winning box cutters. Oh, sorry. Shit. Can we go back to the start?
So John's got a Kronos award. Yeah. I've got two Kronos awards. Do you have a Kronos award?
No. This has been fun of my lack of awards.
I guess someone can't be part of our club.
But really, Lovecraft, racist, homophobe, etc. Why do we have his head on a plinth? Really?
Maybe to teach him a lesson.
As an award.
Because he's one of the fathers of modern fantasy.
Oh, they're all assholes, all of them, aren't they? They're all
possibly
shits.
Possibly so.
Yeah, anyway.
Moving on.
Yes. Everyone sucks. That's what we've learned there.
Yeah, everyone. No, your dreams, forget about them. Everyone sucks.
All your dreams are dead and everyone
sucks. And the world's made up of 12-year-old girls.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. That's a new one for me.
Yeah.
All right, books.
That's why the high-pitched voice. Ah, I get it. I get it.
You're trying to get back at me, and that's really bad. And to do it live on a podcast.
Well.
Yeah, you got no.
I didn't bring my.
She's got no
stick.
Comeback. Can we get to the books? We're going to do Room first. Oh, we recommend.
Possibly introduce.
Yeah, we're doing three books. We're doing three books. Generation X, which is your book that you recommended, John. Secret History of. I was going to say Secret History of Donna Tartt.
That's a completely different book.
Which is your the Secret History, which is your recommendation, and mine, which we're doing first, Room by Emma Donoghue.
Yes.
Can I have the back of the book? Because I read it on the iPad, so I don't.
This one's no good. It's only got blurbs on the.
Do I really need to?
This one's got a little.
Thank you. Not that we need to really.
This
describe
is weird.
It,
here's another example. Remember with the 100,000 Kingdoms?
Yeah.
It only had quotes. Yeah. About the, well, this is the same. My copy of Room only has quotes from people saying.
They used to only do that with hardcovers.
And it's the paperback. It's not the trade. It's the next level down, and there's nothing about the actual book itself.
Well, there is on the inside.
Well, but the inside front cover. But I mean, not on the back.
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Anyway. Jack is 5 and excited about his birthday. He lives with his ma in Room, which has a locked door and a skylight and measures 11 feet by 11 feet. He loves watching TV, especially Dora. Oh, those bits. And the cartoon characters he calls friends, but he knows that nothing he sees on screen is truly real, only him. Ma and the things in Room. Only him, Ma and the things in Room. I'll get that right one day. Until the day Ma admits that there's a world outside. ... That's so basically it's about a 5-year-old boy and his mother trapped in a room because they've been put there by a naughty man.
A naughty man.
Yeah, well.
this is what I was mentioned before we started. I said, because I'm often quite slow on the uptake with the stuff, that I've been listening to The Writer and the Critic since you guys started without realising it was a speculative fiction podcast.
Yes.
Like in my head, it was just literary, which happened to be speculative fiction based,
which is fine.
Read that way anyway, so that seemed normal. And so when I read this, it was interesting because I didn't read the back at all. I just started this. I knew nothing about the book, and I started from the beginning. And I thought it was interesting that. So at the beginning, I thought, well, maybe they're in a capsule. Maybe they've been separated because there's a plague.
Maybe they're true.
I thought, but isn't it fascinating that because as fans, as spec fiction fans, we get to have way more options with this stuff. And it wasn't until I got to the point where, oh, it's just the Fritzl case. Oh, okay. Now I know yes. what it is. Which is kind of funny because anyone else reading it's going to have read that.
Well, she denies that it's 100% the Fritzl. She said she was inspired by Fritzl.
No, she says it's what, she doesn't deny it. Oh my God, you're just terrible. She doesn't deny it. She said that was one of the cases that inspired her, and there's a couple others.
It's actually nowhere near as horrible as the Fritzl case. The real Fritzl case is... It's about a woman who's been abducted and locked in a room.
The Fritzl case is the dad was raping the daughter.
It was the daughter. She was there for a lot longer. This
24
woman's been
years.
There
for, yeah, 24 the daughter years. Was there for 24
she
years.
She had seven kids. One died. Three of them were adopted by the upstairs. They're known as the upstairs children and the downstairs children.
Yeah.
The other ones grew up with her. They were like 19 and 20. The oldest one, they got let out. One of them's got stooped because the basement they lived in wasn't actually tall enough to stand up in.
That's horrible.
So it is weird that she's written this, you know, this story about this horrible thing happening to this woman and this child, but she's actually nowhere near as horrible as the event that is inspired it, which is...
To be honest, thank God for that, because I found it hard enough to read the first half.
It would be a very different book. And I think if you kept more closely to the details of it would definitely be a horrible.
I'm really glad she didn't. I mean, it's kind of nice, because she also said in an interview that she wanted to talk about... It's Jack, particularly, she's talking about... But she didn't want the bad guy. She didn't want the kind of the abductor to be the story.
Yeah.
And so he's quite clearly in the story. He's more a plot device than... And that's kind of good in a way, because it means you can focus on Jack and Ma without having to get hung up on that part of it.
No, it is. And especially in the second half, it really... He's not involved at all. Mm. He becomes irrelevant. He's basically a catalyst for the events of the story. I found the first half. Look, again, I have a 17-month-old baby, and this is really tough to read when you're reading from a 5-year-old being abused in the way. Although Jack's happy.
Jack's and not that's real. I mean, apart from the fact that he's like locked in this basement. Well, it's not a basement. It's like
it's a shed.
It's a shed. It's a shed. It's a shed. Yeah.
You don't really know quite what it is until they actually get out.
Yeah.
But So I mean, apart from that situation, he's not actually abused.
He's also not unhappy. This is the thing I actually thought was really interesting about the book, was because she where it succeeds is when it is Jack's perception of the world, and this is the world to Jack. And he likes a lot of this. He's with his mum. He really loves his mum. They get along really well.
He likes them.
They
have fun. He doesn't know there's an outside.
And so the routine. He loves the routine.
Yeah, he's not missing
anything.
Because
he was born in the room. It's not like he was kidnapped from the world.
He spent his entire life in this room.
Yeah.
Him pointing out the birth stain.
Yeah. on the rug. Yeah. Everything's named in the room. Like, rug has a capital R. Like, they're all his friends.
Yeah. Rug and bed and spoon and
this is the weird thing.
Melty spoon.
And I don't know how much we can talk about this. I don't know how
spoilers are. We assume people. This is why I don't know why I read the blurb, considering we assume people have read the book.
Yeah.
Because it was hard to know with this, because, not knowing where it was going to go. And then when they get out of the room, what I thought was the most interesting thing was that Jack wants to go back.
Yeah.
Like, because that's his world. He doesn't like this.
The world outside's big and noisy, and there are strange people.
And things hurt.
They're cold.
He knows beaches from on TV. There's this thing, things happen in television, which is everything else in the world to him. And now he has to work out which things are television, which things are real.
Yeah.
And they go to the beach, and it's all gritty, and he doesn't like it. Like and I thought that was, to him, everything was better before when it was this vision.
Yeah.
The one review I read of this said that it falls apart in the second half because Jack.
Is that the Guardian review?
No.
Okay. The Guardian said a similar thing.
I haven't finished the point.
Sorry. Go ahead.
This is what she does to me. that it falls apart in the second half because Jack becomes a sort of on-the-nose commentator about what's going on in the world and really basically a voice for the author rather than Jack. We lose Jack, the 5-year-old, in the room, and he becomes this sort of – at times he's still Jack of the room, but he also becomes that, why do people do that?
I sort of disagree with that, except for there's two weird points where the book did that for me. And again, not knowing how spoilery we go, but it's when Jack –
go the full way.
When Jack gets out of the room, they've got this plan to try and escape the room. And it was – for plot purposes, obviously, they do have to get out of the room at that point. But I couldn't help thinking Jack would just freak out completely. Like, I actually didn't believe Jack would function
as well. Yeah, because he gets rolled up in a rug and he's been forced to be sick and he's...
But he's never seen Sky. Like, I can't think he's going to get out of the truck and just freak out completely and freeze and be useless. Yeah. But he actually operates...
It's like complete sensory overload, it would be. And he copes with that really well.
Way too well. I kind of felt
that. Well, he can't talk to the guy with the dog. That's the thing. He's not actually able to voice, and it's only because he's slightly injured that the guy with the dog...
Yeah.
But he still copes, for me, too well. And the other point was later on, and this is the bit that actually I was quite annoyed because she lost me completely, was when there's an interview with Ma. I've forgotten the character's name is given. And the implication is it's someone like a Barbara Waters character
who's
trying to sensationalize the story.
Yes.
That would never happen because it's a sensational story.
Yes.
You know, there's no need. Like, it just wouldn't happen. They would have sent, like, the top guy, because it would have been a man, not a woman, would have got that gig because it's a big story.
Yeah.
And they would have sent the guy from 60 Minutes and he would have just done the interview. Like, you don't have to make the story of the woman who's been locked up in a shed for 9 years into something sensational.
Yeah, you're right. There is that sort of tabloid feel to that
but
interview.
But that felt like a comment.
Yeah.
I forget the name of the American news. Well, I'm not going to call her a journalist because she's not really blonde, big haired. I can't remember. But she interviewed a girl, a teenage girl in the States who was kidnapped and held captive for a long, long time when she was a child. And they found her or she escaped. I can't remember the exact details of the case, when she was about 15. And this woman did interview on the and it was exactly like that. I mean, she's horrible. And this is what this woman does all the time, apparently.
Because my assumption would be a story that big. And you don't need to.
It was the exact thing. Like, can you like, how horrible was it? And can you tell us? Did he do this? Did he do that? And I've sort of seen YouTube clips of that. And it's really awful. Because it is an awful case. It's like, you're just trying to... So maybe she was riffing, and it was a few years older.
And that may well be what Emma Donoghue is referencing.
That,
but for me, it was just that thing. That's where she lost me, going, no, you're making a comment about American interview and media
sensationalism,
which I don't. Yeah, I didn't believe it, but now you pointed out it's probably actually true.
Yeah, I think she might be referencing this particular woman.
See,
the
first half of the book to me is wall to wall brilliant. The second half has moments of brilliance, but there are points where you go, you sort of made your point. The point's obvious in the second half, whereas in the first half, it's this wonderful. It is actually a bit of a science fiction novel, actually, that first half, because it's his child create world building to understand the world around him, which is literally the size of your house.
Yeah, yeah. we're in my tiny house at the moment.
That's a terrible thing to say. I can't imagine.
You're a horrible man in my tiny land room. We have a cat on the table
but
as well.
But to be fair, if he had the robot from Doctor Who and how many fucking Daleks he got here, 1, 2, 3, 4,
yeah.
I think he'd have been a lot of 5. He's been a lot happier as a – and the cats.
And two cats.
Yeah. But yeah, it just – yeah, when he goes to live with the mother, I mean, it's all so predictable as well. You know, and her family, the daughter's – the girl's family are not understanding of what's happened. I mean,
I think a lot of it is literally not understanding. I think unless you've been in that situation, how do you understand? I mean, how you understand what's happened? You understand she'll be traumatized, but how do you? And we get to understand it because we got put in there. But how do you actually understand that? Like, how do you really understand?
Really, Kirsten? Really?
I agree with that. And also because there is
from a child's point of view, like, how do you really understand what it would be like to have never known
anything? Because Jack does nothing.
Like, except this room.
Yeah, he doesn't know any of this. So anything they say is going to be confusing to some degree. And, yeah, there's an interesting where Jack has to even work out then what's real and what's not real.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't get the Dora the Explorer as a cartoon because...
Yeah.
Is, you know, it's like, well, is everything on TV real? And it's that point of some of it's real people pretending to be other people. You know, that's kind of in itself a really odd concept.
I don't know. I just found it, I suppose, a little bit on the nose at times in the second half.
Yeah, I thought
it was obvious.
I was glad it went somewhere, though, because that first half, it does.
Well, you feel, how can she sustain this for 350 pages?
Yeah.
They're in the room, and it's pretty intense, too. It's not ladled out, so it's quite full on. And there's a bit of rape thrown in as well because Old Nick comes in and has his bit, his lend of the mother.
And that is interesting contrast though, because the first half it's she knows about the outside world and wants to get out, but Jack doesn't. In the second half, she knows about what this world is and Jack doesn't. And he wants to go back in. So there is a kind of, you know, there's a balance there to the two halves. And the end, I think there also was a thing, because again, I was maybe losing a little bit in that second half, but the end is really good. I think it ties
when they
up.
Go back to the,
they go back and look at the room, and it's such a great
the room's different to Jack now.
Yes, it's changed. It's a different
and he doesn't
space.
Want to be there anymore because now it's not the room. Now it's something else.
It's
duller and it's tired and it's not the space that he wanted to go back to.
Well, I will say that if you are a parent, you probably shouldn't read it.
Oh, well,
I can think of some people. Latanzi, for example, who I know has an aversion to kids being abused. Although Jack is not abused, physically abused. Jack doesn't know even he's being abused.
Yeah, but I don't – I mean, this is the thing. I don't think – and it would have been a very different book if Jack was also being abused by the captor. And the thing
Jack's being abused. There's no other way of putting it. He might not love his world, but that's not normal.
No, but he's not being physically or sexually abused like his mother is.
No.
So, and from Jack's point of view, he's quite happy in the room. So the trauma like that happens to Jack, I don't think – I think if you're a parent, you could read this book. I think Tansy could read this book because nothing like immediately physically awfully horrible happens to Jack. And it's about a child – creating the world from what's around him and, and getting used to the world when it changes.
As a parent, you have the frustration. You want to give the best to your child. She, and you're right, I forgot her name as well, the character's name. She wants to give the best to Jack, but she can't. She's forced to only give him what she can within the 11-foot-by-11 room that they're in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's what, as a parent, you get upset. And Jack himself is not being abused. Yeah. And I'm not even that upset about her abuse, or that's bad. Being raped
by
something.
Pretty bad.
Yeah. But it's more the not being able to provide for your child in the way that you want to.
I should point out, too, just while we're sounding horribly sexist, the fact that we don't remember her name is simply because it's actually not even given until much later in the book.
Yes. Jack knows her as Ma. She's Ma. That's her name. She She's Ma.
And when she gets the other name, Jack's actually quite thrown by it because he's not used to people having.
He doesn't understand that Ma is not her name so much as her signifier.
Yeah.
There's also some other stuff about the sort of abuse angle, and I was thinking this is, again, when I was really impressed. The bits that most impressed me was you discover through other people's kind of references that Jack's malnourished. And it's just so cleverly done because it's all – everything's normal to Jack, and then occasionally you'll realize from something someone else says –
Well, I was going to ask, though, what about the voice of the book? Because she's having a cake and eat it as well.
I didn't buy that, actually, as that's a five-year-old child.
You really, that's
Well, that's interesting because later on Jack meets an actual five-year-old child or a four-year-old child, the Bronwyn, which is his
cousin. Yeah.
And she behaves like a normal child. And he's trying to talk to her, like, you know, having an intelligent, adultish-sounding conversation. And Bronwyn acts like a child and has no idea what's going on. And every time Jack meets a real child, there's just this no connection, and he can't understand why they can't talk normally, which is the thing I think kind of almost apologizes the voice being different.
Yeah, and it's I'm not sure that. Yeah, I didn't quite buy that voice.
The idea is meant to be that obviously that Ma has talked to him as an equal forever, and they have nothing else to do. So it was interesting,
but only reads the same six books to him. So it's not like his vocabulary should be.
But she's been teaching him, and she's a college student. You know, she's
Then I do make a point about his vocabulary being a lot more advanced than others.
It's not just the vocabulary;
it's the verbatim quoting of what people are saying around that sort of convention she uses. That you know, there are people talking around him, and he's literally quoting verbatim, word for word, what they're saying, and not. There's not phonetic spelling. It's all as per normal.
Well, he's not written the book.
Well, I don't know. He's thinking it.
He's thinking it, but he's not.
I know he's not
written the book.
You're the one who has the whole first person issue.
No, because he's not written the book.
I know he's not written the book. I know it's in his mind. We're getting an insight into his mind.
Yeah.
But still, you're saying when the characters around him are talking because it's just a
channel. We're experiencing.
We're getting it kind of live.
Yeah.
In a way.
Okay. All right. Fine.
So he's just a conduit for what's happening.
Okay. No. Fine. I accept that argument.
But it's not so much the vocabulary because I mean little kids will pick up words. But they'll often misuse words they pick up. It's more the some of the, I guess, the analytic stuff and the thought processes. They just don't. I mean, it doesn't matter how well educated a 5-year-old might be. A children's brain works differently to an adult brain, and I just thought some of the logic. Things like it just of the thoughts just didn't read as what a 5-year-old would do.
Is this a first novel?
This is her seventh novel.
Oh, really? Okay.
She's written a lot of historical fiction.
Yeah, this was her breakout novel.
Okay, because it was that thing where I don't know where I didn't know anything about the novel, but that weird thing where I think there could be a better novel. I think this could be a better novel, but I still found it really captivating. And the bits where it's good, it's really good.
Yeah, it is.
And that kind of lets me excuse the bits where it's not so good. So it's a weird, it's a weirdly uneven.
Overall, I enjoyed the book.
Same here.
Yeah.
And it got nominated for the Orange Prize.
It also got shortlisted for the Booker.
Oh, did it?
Yeah. The Man Booker.
Oh, I missed that.
Yep.
Not the Woman Booker.
The Man Booker. And it actually got shortlisted for.
And is this actually her breakout novel? Because I know she's written.
This is pretty much her. They're calling it her breakout novel.
Okay.
But it was a New York Times bestseller.
Such a patronizing term, breakout novel. The other six, well, they're just.
It's just that this is the one that got everybody's attention.
As yeah, opposed I hate the term breakout. Okay. Sounds like you've got pimples. Just I don't like it.
Anyway, it's you can Google it. It's won or been shortlisted for a whole lot of different prizes. It did win the Commonwealth Writers Prize, as well. So it's
where is she from then? I assume she was American, but she
no, she's originally Irish, and she now lives in Canada.
Okay,
I believe it's Canada where she lives now.
Mm-hmm.
But she's Irish.
Well, Canadian. I think if you're a parent, you may struggle with the first half. Not that I did a bit, but I recommend it.
Well, I mean,
we've spoiled it to buggery, but doesn't matter. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, I'll just say this: we've pretty much told you the situation and the story of the book, and there aren't any gruesome details we've left out.
No.
So you know, if you're okay to read about what we've told you about, then that's cool because we've not hidden anything from you. There's not some horrible, nasty little scene that is going to freak you out if you're a parent.
Yeah, except, well, I'm going to say it. Jack counts how many times old Nick is thrusting into Mummy from the wardrobe because he can't see it, but he can hear it.
He doesn't know what it is, though.
No, he just hears the noise, the creaky of the, or the gasping and the creaking. He counts it. If no one finds that disturbing, then they're not human. That's
disturbing, but it's not it's a different, because it's not happening to Jack.
I understand. It's like, I get that.
It's more disturbing to us than it is to Jack. Yes. Therefore, we can be.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Which was actually quite, I mean, that was one of the clever things about the first part of the book, that you do read some things and you're thinking, this is just fucked up. and Jack's in the room going, oh, I wish they'd finished. I want to finish the dessert and the milk and the spoon and Dora's on TV soon and I'm going to miss that.
Her Dora bit is brilliant. It is the show. She encapsulates Dora perfectly with boots and swipey and the other one and Vanimus.
Because I'm unfamiliar with Dora, I didn't follow all of that.
Oh, she's got it on the nose. Bang. Right. Dora. Well done. If there's one book you read this year about Dora, it should be Room by Emma Donoghue. It really should be. Because she obviously watched quite a lot of it.
I'm sure she did.
We're going to move on to the second book. How long have we been going for so far?
I don't know, 40 minutes or so. That's fine.
40 minutes, okay.
Well, about 40 minutes.
All right, fine.
So we can move on to the next book.
Which is slightly longer than the book we just discussed.
slightly.
And which I finished today on the bus.
Oh, really?
Yes.
How long did it take you? I'm curious.
I think about 9 or 10 days.
Okay.
Although I really picked up pace in the last 5 days.
Right.
Yeah, because I knew Kirsten would yell at me if I hadn't finished it.
I would yell at you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're not allowed to finish books anymore.
This is your choice, Kirsten.
This was my choice.
She has been crying about this book
this book over 10 years
ago.
Yeah, okay.
And she's been crying about it since then.
A long, long time. Actually, when I was still back in uni, over 15 years ago.
Tell us what this book is and why you've chosen it.
He's now the host of the podcast. Well, I'm done. I've decided to resign.
Well, this is The Secret History by Donna Tartt. And this was published in 1992.
Yes.
And it's basically the story of these 5 college students in this sort of wealthy private college in Vermont. No, it's the 5 in the group.
Okay.
Right? And they're classic students at this wealthy private college. And then the narrator of this story gets a scholarship, and it's kind of like on a whim he applies for this thing because he doesn't know quite what to do. He's a bit of a drifter, a bit of a slacker. And he gets this scholarship because he's actually quite talented academically in the arts and the liberal arts, not creative arts. And he gets his scholarship to the college. He goes to the college and he kind of falls in with this group of strange classic students who are they're the only ones in their class, and their class is all their classes, because if you get taken under the wing of Julian Morrow, who's a classics instructor, he basically teaches you everything. You don't get to go to other classes. You're kind of insulated. And so Richard, who's the narrating character, falls in with this group of people. And the story is told as a retrospective from many, many years later. He's telling you the story of what happened when he was at college. And you know from the outset, because you get this prologue, that what happened was one of the 5 was killed by the others, including Richard. And then the book is the story of how this happened and why it happened and what effect it had on all of them afterwards. And it's really engrossing. And I was a little hesitant to reread it for the podcast, but I knew I had to, because otherwise I wouldn't really remember.
You reread
much.
A 629-page book.
Of course I did.
The things I'll do for this podcast.
And I was amazed, A, how much I still love the book, because I was a little worried, and B, how things I had misremembered or confabulated about the book, which was really strange, but we can come to those. But it is still a really good book. It's not a murder mystery in that you don't know what might happen, because you know the crime from the prologue, it's done, although you almost forget about it by the time it happens. It's like, oh, that's right, they're gonna kill him. But it's the story of why it happened, and it's basically just about these interactions between these really strange, socially awkward, archaic in some ways
assholes.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I didn't like any of them.
Well, this was because I had – this was a slog. I found this book so hard, I couldn't pick it up. It was just
– Really?
It felt like such work. And what was interesting, yesterday I said, oh, I'm doing the writing critic, and this is one book which I really hated this book. I hated this book so much, and I need to fly back from Sydney, so I haven't wasted my time hating this book, and I can tell people how much I hate this book. And they should. And they said, oh, what is it? And I said, oh, it's Jonathan Tartt. I went, I love that book! And it's that thing like Sopranos, right? Sopranos. Okay, I get the Sopranos is a really good TV show. I can appreciate it's a really good TV show. I haven't watched much of it, I'm not that interested in it. I might watch it eventually, but I get it's a good show. I think this is a terribly, terribly written book. I think awful.
Really?
There's no structure at all of any sort, even down to the first 150 pages, nothing happens.
No, true.
Then one of the characters says, oh, by the way, we killed someone 100 pages ago. Didn't mention that, but why weren't we following that? Why were we not
following that? It's true. Richard, the main character, does follow the least interesting
Harry
Blunt.
He's the most passive character. And not only is he passive, he does nothing in the first half. And then the second half, he's either asleep or drunk. Those are the two things he alternates doing. Whenever anything happens,
he's on high on coke or drugs.
I know. And whenever anything happens, it's told to him anecdotally by somebody else. Yep. Oh yes, this other thing happened. Why did we not? And I went, okay, either she has no idea what structure is, or it's some incredibly clever post-structural. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's like, oh, it's classics. Maybe it's a whole Greek thing that all the drama happens off stage.
Actually, I think it's a Pomo thing.
Okay, because then at one point, then there's a horrible act that happens in front of him. You're going, okay, so it's not even that. It's not even she's playing that game. And like you're saying, Richard goes on about how awesome these people are. Oh, they're amazing and mysterious and incredible and ethereal. And you're going, no, they're wankers you find at any other spot.
How wankers? You know, he's a wanker too.
Yeah.
And his teacher is clearly a dreadful, dreadful teacher. And he goes on about, oh, he's amazing. Because the teacher has all these horrible purple prose about all beauty is pain, chuckles Julian looking out the window. You know, it's like, he's clearly been doing the same speech every year and you think this is somehow, you know. And I just hated everyone. And I was like, is he meant to be an unreliable, you know, narrator? Is that the point?
He's not unreliable. I think what I find really interesting about Richard's narrative and the way that Donna Tartt has crafted the book is that by taking this character who is an outsider character and an observer character and completely passive and does nothing, almost to the point that he dies of pneumonia.
Yes, yes, there's like, yeah. It's like 1,400 pages where he goes off on a little holiday.
This is because this is one of the things I misremembered. Yeah. And I was talking to someone who'd read the book also a long time ago, and I was saying, oh, I'm rereading it for the podcast. And I was saying, oh, and I'm really looking forward to reading it because I hadn't read it at this stage when I was talking about it. And also, she's saying, oh, I don't remember that much about it. I said, oh, I really remember this great, huge section in the middle where they're away and it's winter and he's in this cold thing and he's slogging back and forth to the university to do his assistant work and then back home to this horrible place where he just about dies because it's freezing and there's a hole in the roof.
And he's too stupid.
And I said it's a brilliant bit because it really underscores this whole character, the way he will not move out of a situation. He just will not. He can't. He's got no momentum of his own. And I said, it just goes for 8. It goes for 20 pages.
It does.
No,
it
you
does.
Lie.
No, I feel don't. Like
no, because it feel feels way
I
long.
Know. I mean, I've read this, it and I went, you're joking.
This book
it?
Is 650 pages long. It could easily be halved with no difference to
but
the
But that bit
effect.
Is like 20 pages.
It feels like ever.
I know. That's a bit I misremembered. I'm reading it. I'm reading it. I'm going,
there's one
no,
bit.
This can't be right.
She spends 3 pages to tell you that Julian once taught a princess from a fictional
fiction. Bizarre.
It has
why
nothing. It shouldn't be there. It should have been cut.
Why did she pull a fictional? Why do the fictional
The whole thing's fiction. I mean, Vermont.
Oh, really?
I mean, no. I'm saying like the college is fictional. It's probably based on her college that she went
there's
to.
There's a bit of the very end.
Can I just say before we get to the very end, it is also Lightroom, a book of two halves.
Yeah.
The first half is about leading up to the murder, but you're right. That second half.
That murder we're mentioning though, that's the second murder. There's actually a first murder.
Yeah.
They don't even care. You don't even talk anything about who they murdered because he was a farmer from Vermont.
I know.
A Vermonter.
Yeah. They're horrible people.
They are. But I'm just saying that first stuff I actually found really, really interesting.
Because there's
sort of a world-building element to it, this group, who are they? But once you find out who they are and what they've done and all that, the second half is just them disintegrating and it fucking gets boring after a while. So I struggle with the second half.
Because I genuinely don't get it at all. And I went and read all these reviews. I'm going, I love this book. I'm going, why? I genuinely cannot see
it. She's here. I mean,
that's why I wanted to know.
Between you two because I really love the first half, including the bit when he's in the snow. But by the second half, I'm going, okay. Because it's not just him getting drunk. Charles gets drunk every second. Charles is an alcoholic.
Takes it very badly.
Francis seems to just want to bum everyone and get drunk.
I couldn't even work out who Francis was halfway through. He was like, end character 7. It was like, what the hell is that character?
You see, out of all of them, it's probably Francis who I like the best.
Henry, if you knew Henry, and they keep saying we love Henry, especially at the end.
But Henry's
you take Henry, and I swear you just smack him until he bled really a lot through his ears.
But Henry's the one who's controlling everything.
I know.
I should also mention that, distractingly, the twins are called Charles and Camilla.
Yeah.
Which I actually have to go and check the publishing date because it threw me so much. So that's a bit on the nose, isn't it?
Yes.
It lost me, I got to say, when we find out again at the end, towards the end, that Charles and Camilla are incestuous. I thought, could you fucking be more? I thought, that's going to happen. From page one, they're incestuous, aren't they?
She's a terrible character, though.
I could have lived without that.
She's a dreadful character. Yeah. She's this horrible.
All the women are in it.
One girl who's presented as being a thing of strange mystery and beauty.
Because
she's sort of ugly looking and pale.
We're taking one of her favourite books and kicking it in the cock.
I absolutely agree with that. But I think what is great about, because I absolutely view this book as being, I mean, it is a first-person narrative, and everything is through Richard's eye, and Richard's an idiot.
Mm.
This is how he sees Camilla. Oh, she's ethereal, she's beautiful. It's like, she's a dick.
Yeah, yeah.
You can't see that, you stupid boy. I mean, and I love that because I think the novel is so loyal to that concept of creating this. I mean, it's really unusual to have a passive narrator, and funnily enough,
that works.
As I'm reading this, I'm thinking, when did I read this book? When did I start writing my first novel with the passive male narrator? I think this book actually was a bit of
only in terms of having a
passive narrator.
Mm-hmm. Thematic in mind.
Yeah, because it's really hard to write. And I think Donna Tartt does it incredibly well because she's loyal to that concept. She doesn't make him this great heroic guy who comes through at the end. She doesn't make him, even at the end, he's not even thinking back and going, oh, I was an idiot. He's still thinking, this was the most formative thing of my life.
But doesn't that still make him a really boring character? I mean, shouldn't we be following one of the others who actually does something? Wouldn't that have made more sense?
They're all horrible anyway. I mean, whose head do you want to be in?
Oh, so is he. Every so often, he gets bored of them, which I was, you know, every single page. And he goes off and goes to a party with Judy Poovey. Or
no, Judy Poovey.
And every time that happens, the book comes into colour. It's like you feel like something's actually happening. It's like people actually do stuff.
Because there's people there on the outside. I mean, I love the world she's created, and I mean, I
when they go to the Cochrane's, when they go to the Cochrane's for the funeral, that is hilarious.
I know.
Is very funny.
I know
these fuckwit family.
But it's again out of a completely different book, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It does feel like it's like a sitcom.
It's a Joe Wharton play.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's odd.
But that's Bunny. I mean, that was Bunny all the way through. You see exactly where Bunny came from.
Actually, the book loses when Bunny goes, when he gets killed.
Yeah.
The book loses momentum. And because he is actually one of the most interesting characters. He's more interesting than Henry.
But
Henry's
Bunny's
a fuckwit.
Awful, though.
But he's awful in that sort of way, a car crash sort of way.
Yeah,
you can't help but watch.
The thing is, I wanted them to kill Bunny. Like, by the time,
by the time of
the novel, when they're going to kill him, it's like, you fucking kill him.
Bunny is at least an antagonist, though, which gives you something to happen.
Yeah.
That's all about the structure.
And then I felt really awful.
Come on, John, did you think the second half would be about them all trying to try to kill each other and, you know, people, you know, all planning to, because I thought that's how it was going to go.
In all honesty, every time I pick this up, I just switch my brain off. I just let words go in. Because honestly, if I hadn't hadn't been reading this for this, I would have abandoned it around about a page 170.
It's beloved.
It's beloved.
It's also worth noting, I think she actually thanks him, or does she even dedicate it
Brett Easton Ellis. His books are shorter.
There's some crossover characters.
Oh, bullshit.
Oh, really?
Mentioned. Mentioned in passing. There's the girl who commits suicide in this book.
Well, this is the thing I was going to mention.
So there's a little bit of, I mean, like her and Easton Ellis, were at least at the time, I don't know about now, but I mean, they're obviously friends. And
I thought you were going to say they were shagging.
I don't know about that. But I mean, they were friends and obviously collaborating in some sense, not in terms of co-writing a book, but in terms of, you know, their work.
So it's like the DC universe.
That's immediately what I thought. It was like, crisis on boring little earths.
But at this time, you've got Easton Ellis writing The Rules of Attraction and those kind of books, which are also these college books with this affected people you don't like. And I just...
It's the fucking 90s. Chuck Palahniuk's doing it in the 90s. We're about to talk about a book that's got, I mean, they're slightly more likeable, but similar sort of people. It's the fucking 90s. It was a wasteland, in a sense.
The thing I was going to mention at the end, because I was talking about how stupidly long this is, too, and this kind of ties in with that, because that might make more sense of it. There's a bit where suddenly Richard tells you what happened to all the other characters you didn't notice or care about. In the entire book.
It's like,
and they all have happy endings.
But it's like,
I know.
Isn't that amazing? They've all had happy endings, but he's. Anyway,
that's what the book's doing, that the book is saying.
But it's like a tedious Christmas letter from a family you don't know. It's like, I don't care. I didn't care about you lot. Why do I care about the secondary character?
You care about Judy Poovey.
I care about Judy Poovey. Because every time he leaves those people, it goes back to this horrible sepia tinted, people going, oh no, I don't have a television. Punch them in the face.
I know.
150 pages. Why?
That's why I like it, because I agree with everything you said, but I like it because
of that. Why do you like it? That's why I think I'm just having that.
I don't know, because I find these characters fascinating. I find it incredibly interesting that she can write this 600-page book with people I don't like. Mm-hmm. And don't think are cool. And even when I read it the first time when I was 20 something, I didn't think they were cool. But I can still want to know, like, what makes them work.
But there's an aimlessness to the last half. I love the first half. Yeah. I'm disagree with you there. I love the bit with the snow and he's sitting in the room. Yeah. I thought you were a fuckwit.
The whole room.
But I actually felt cold. The writing got me. You're wrong there. But the second half is aimless. Nothing. They're all fuckwits. You hated them anyway. The guy committed the murder. Okay, there's the bit with the FBI agents, which seems like it's going to be vaguely interesting and go somewhere. Yeah. And then that goes nowhere either. And, you know, I mean, there was that comic thing about how they fucking killed him and thought they'd people would find the body the next day, and it snows. That's hilarious.
But even the first murder, the one that no one cares about.
Which is really graphic. They pull his organs out.
But that, the other thing really upset me, too, was that no one cared. They all didn't care about this Vermont farmer.
Because what Richard cares about is things that are beautiful and poetic.
It's true.
And nice.
But also this thing where, like, 100 pages.
So he doesn't care, because who cares about a Vermont farmer?
But nothing's happened, and they go, oh, by the way, we had a Dionysian ritual, and she turned into an elk, and we killed someone.
The guy we
and
think,
stuff. Yeah,
think
I don't
maybe.
Remember. It was awesome. We were trees for a day, I think. And you're going, at the very least, should we not have had that scene? Because something might have happened.
But Richard wasn't there. And this is the thing, again, Richard is outside of everything. I mean, Richard...
Except for the last shocking moment of the book.
Because the thing is, Richard so wants to be in them, and they don't really care about Richard. They
don't
like
Richard.
Well, the
whole point is that, in a sense, he's been brought in.
Yeah,
you get the feeling that Henry's
as a scapegoat.
As a
he's going to be a scapegoat at some point, and he manages to literally dodge that bullet. But he's so pathetic.
But also
and he's pathetic at the end.
I think Chris is right that she pulls off the narrative trick of having a pathetic character be interesting and to be and the world building for the first half is interesting, but there is a point when Charles gets drunk for the 14th time and Frances goes, I'm not really attracted to you, but I sort of want to have sex with you, and Camilla or Millie falls in love with Henry
ethereal.
And Henry just fucking acts like Mycroft Holmes had to describe and such, and you just want to fucking punch him because he's fixing the roses. And Julian, I actually thought there'd be this revelation that Julian actually knew all along what they were doing. I thought there'd be some point to Julian. That's why, you know, and there isn't.
No, Julian's just the dressing to hold them together.
And then he goes off to produce the chaser.
Yeah.
But it's really
it's the same name.
It's Julian Morrow.
Julian Morrow, Charles and Camilla. Oh my god!
But it is really weird because Julian's presented this. Figure they all looked up to. Oh, he controls them. And nothing. He doesn't do
They're
anything.
They're all idiots. They're all pretentious.
The early '90s was a wasteland of fiction.
Again, I don't understand, Kirsten.
Because I find it fascinating.
But why weren't you? I mean, you know, you were slightly younger 17 years ago. Slightly, you know, not much younger than you are now. 19 years ago it was. Why weren't you reading it then? Because this is a, you know, a zeitgeist novel, isn't it?
It is. And I think this is the thing. I do wonder how, like, all those people, I love it. Like, if they've read it again, would, because I'd still like it, but I'd like it kind of, and you know the.
Oh, you're backtracking.
No, I do, but I like it in different ways.
Well, this is interesting. This is
like, I still really like it.
Generation X as well. This is why we need to talk about this one first. But it's interesting. We both kind of did this thing of, let's go back and look at a book that really affected us in 91.
And I really like the narrative. I like what she's doing. I like, and I think the voice of Richard is really strong.
It is, but he's such a fucker.
He is. So and you just want to.
And women, he treats women like shit. And it's interesting.
Idiot. He's a complete.
Because women are treated terribly in this novel. Men aren't. Don't get
it. It is actually weird.
Because that's what Richard does. Richard's awful.
But it's interesting that a female novelist has written such terrible female characters. Yeah. That is a kind of interesting
thing. She's not written
thing.
Terrible female characters. She's written a male narrator who views women like that. Oh, and I think that's really clever. No, that's what she's done.
But let's be honest. Let's do the whole argument. If a guy had written this book, if a guy had written the exact same book, if it was Jim Tart.
Sorry, I had that in my head. It's G-Y-M.
Leon Tart.
What do cheerleaders have to do with anything? Yeah.
But you know, if a man had written it, do you think it would have...
I don't know. That's because Bret Easton Ellis was writing books with really horrible people as well. And
I think it was of the time. You know. It's of the time, of the early 90s.
But, I mean, other people can read it in a different way. I read it fully through Richard's eyes. So, yeah, I don't see horrible women characters. I see a male narrator who sees women like this. And I think he's
And
awful.
Then, therefore, it's going to be a struggle for some people to read
the
book.
You know, so, I mean, this is the complete angel whore thing, because Millie is the angel and she can do no wrong and she's wonderful, mysterious and ethereal and beautiful, and everyone else is just a, you know, whore. And that's Richard.
But even she is a terrible character, because even though he sees her that way, we the reader know that she's just a waste of space.
Yeah. But Judy Poovey isn't. And
no, but he sees them as waste
of
space.
Of course he does. But we know they're not. We know that they're the people who
should
be
interesting. A man.
That's actually interesting. You're right. Because I kept going, please stay with them. Exactly. Please, I don't want to go back to those people.
It's like, you know, they're the people he should actually be hanging around with.
It's
and he's
interesting.
Made a terrible mistake.
I'm reading this as the bloke, and I'm thinking, can you root Judy Poovey already? Can you just root that? Oh, root them. And he doesn't. He's all, I'd be learning myself.
Judy would be so up for it.
Oh, yeah, Judy Poovey.
Oh, yeah, she's pretty.
I want to write slash fiction about Judy Poovey and Richard, you know, because that's what I did after
Poovey
I finished this.
Judy Poovey and Richard?
Yeah, that's my point, because I wanted them to get, you know.
Maybe Judy Poovey and Bunny.
Here's one question that someone asked me, one of the people who did say, but that book's awesome, you suck.
Was that Woodley or Judy and Judith Lucy?
No, that was actually... Well, one of them was my lovely friend Erin, who let me stay in her house the second night. Thank you, Erin, who works on the book show. And said she'll try and tweet this.
Lovely.
This is all happening. So hello to any listener, viewer of the book.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the book club has joined us. But...
The Tuesday one, the Marika.
Yeah.
She's cute.
So it was just that thing, Marika, and I discussed punctuation. That was,
really?
It was going off at the ABC party last night.
She was there?
Yeah, she was there. Oh, and the ABC slogan this year is, what's not to love? !
No!
Yeah. And.
This is why we need to bring back the Interrobang.
I swear to God. We're the same person.
Exactly.
it's weird because I was.
Do you know the key for the Interrobang on Word?
No. Is it built in?
What the fuck are you talking about?
The Interrobang.
What is that?
It was invented in the
60s. Exactly. That's exactly. You needed one for that sentence. For that. When you just said, what is that? You needed an Interrobang at the end of that sentence.
Invented by admin in the 60s to try and create a new punctuation mark. It's a combination of question mark and exclamation mark for rhetorical questions or for.
It looks like if you type. A question like on a typewriter.
Yes,
if you typed a question mark and an exclamation mark over each other, it would look like an Interrobang.
That really caught
on. What's going on here? Yeah, it's like that kind of So that'd be like, you know, what's not to love?
So instead of like when you have with email and Twitter tweets and shit like that when you do question mark, exclamation mark, and it looks a bit ditzy.
And Lovely Sophia.
You just have one elegant punctuation mark.
Because Lovely Sophia and I had this conversation after Marika and I had gone, it should be a question. It should be a question mark. And so I was like, no, it's not a question. It's a sort of statement. I was going, it's still a rhetorical question. Anyway, Sophia's a big fan of this book.
Yeah, that's
Sophia. Yes, once we get to the argument about question marks.
Sorry for the punctuation segue there.
I think this argument had happened quite a lot in the ABC, and then you know, people like me and Marika Hardy going, no. Anyway, she said, did you know what year it was set in?
No, she's really good at that.
Which is kind of interesting. I hadn't.
Well, you can work out that, it's post Nixon.
It's post moon landing.
Yeah, it's post.
There's a few references.
There are references.
It's definitely late 80s.
Yeah.
There is a computer. I assumed it was set the same year it was written, but she was saying it's actually really hard to tell. Because especially when you go with the tiresome gang, as I'll call them, they live in the 1930s. This most reminded me of Evelyn Waugh's Brideshead Revisited, and that is not a good thing.
You like that too, don't you?
I've not actually read Brideshead Revisited.
I deliberately
Evelyn's a guy.
I haven't read the last three pages because I hated it so much I didn't want to give it the satisfaction of finishing it.
But you finish this
because I'm coming on your podcast and I'm you know,
have
professionalism.
To finish it.
Yeah,
that dream at the very end, did that mean something?
The dream at the end.
Yeah. And what you kissed the microphone.
The book was over.
No, well, look.
When Henry comes back and says, "Well, you're not happy either," kind of. That dream.
No, yeah, the one where he goes to... Well, no, the dream where he walks into this museum, futuristic museum, and Henry's there and Henry
says... Yeah, Henry says...
Yeah, that bit.
And he
yeah,
asks Henry if he's happy and Henry says no, but neither are you, so...
Yeah.
Ta-da!
that is very 90s, though, to be honest.
It is of its time. Yeah. It's definitely of its time.
And they replaced Nirvana albums.
What do people... No, really, what are on Goodreads and Amazon and wherever else? What were they saying that was
people
so good it. About
people
it?
People really genuinely...
But why?
And the thing, they'll say it's like whodunit where you know whodunit, but it's, you know, it's the emotional complexity of the characters.
It's
a
whodunit.
I do wonder, without, again, saying horribly sexist, whether this appeals to women more, because the ones, everyone I've talked to who loved it were women, and... I think a lot of these reviews were women, and whether it's a thing of it's a character
we do read
getting
more,
inside
know.
The head thing. No, because I'm thinking. Look, Adam Richard has this theory about comedy. I will tell you, Adam Richard's
okay.
Adam Richard's comedy theory, which kind of connects to this. Could be horribly sexist, but we'll go with it. He says that men and women approach comedy in the same way they approach basically lovemaking and orgasms. So for men, it's the punchline. Men just want the punchline. That's all they're interested in.
True.
Yeah, you know, they don't care about what they're up to. Punchline. Whereas women actually enjoy the experience of the comedy, and they actually like the kind of, you know, often it's the character. It's the character of the, it's not necessarily the jokes. Men just want the jokes. Women want the character.
I agree. That is sexist. I agree. Right. Sexist. But possibly true.
And I kind of wonder if that's part
of it. Can I just say women want the fucking punchline? I'm sorry.
But I wonder if it was this. If it was like, because this is.
Well, you got the punchline. It's page
characters.
One. Page one's the punchline.
Right.
They push him over the fucking ravine. That's the punchline. The rest of it's the joke.
Maybe that's why women like the book, because we get the punchline first.
Yeah, and then you get to immerse into the characters.
It's like, okay, you took care of us.
And I do wonder if I didn't know Bunny was going to die at the beginning, maybe I actually would have enjoyed it more because I would have thought, I wonder where it's going to go, rather than I know where it's gone.
Because it didn't twist away from
it. It's interesting.
Like, Bunny was killed in the book exactly the way he was in the prologue.
But wait.
It didn't twist away from that.
Wait. That first, 500 words?
Yeah.
Before we get to anything new, because I checked, it's about page 480.
Mm.
So those first 900 words are encapsulated in the first 480 pages, because really that talks about the 10 days it took to find him and, you know, all the shit that happened. So the only new material that we're not aware of is the last 140 pages.
There's even one point, I think, later in the book where I think it's, you know, the police and whatever, and he says, like, of course they didn't find out it was us and yada, yada, yada. Anyway, let's go back to the plot. It tells you that the bit you're reading isn't going to go anywhere.
Because you've got a narrator at the end of the story, so he knows everything.
Yeah, but he might have got away, because he wasn't directly involved in either murder.
Yeah.
Or he might be in prison, or he might be somewhere, but it's nothing of... Yeah,
he probably knows on death row, for you know, Kirsten. Look, we've taken your beloved book and...
but Kirsten still loves it. That's how powerful it is. It stands up to
you. Because this is the thing, I agree with everything you've said.
I actually didn't find it a drudge to read until the last... And really, it was only the last couple of days I found it
a bit
annoying.
You know, the other thing I misremembered, which I find fascinating. I don't know why I've misremembered it. I thought Francis died. Like, I remembered the suicide. I just thought it would, like, I remembered it as a suicide. He died. And he didn't in the book. He has a suicide attempt, but then he's in hospital and he lives unhappily ever after. But that was like a shock. It's like, what? It's like, And this isn't my original copy of the book. I loaned my original copy to someone. And I actually thought for a second, has this been rewritten? Do they make him live now?
Well, it is hilarious how you said 20 yeah. pages on that living in the snowy building thing. Because, I think also because it took me like a week and a half, I think, just to
it
read
just
that.
Felt like, yeah. In my head, it was this section. It was like
can I ask you?
Thick section.
Donna wrote this book, then the second book. But the second book came out many years later and apparently was dreadful.
Yeah, it's notorious for some reason. What is it?
Good. And it's my the little friend, my little friend. Well, I really should know that. It's either – no, I think it's –
because you read it, didn't you?
I bought it in hardcover. I was so looking forward to it because I really love The Secret History and I was very disappointed.
What's it about?
Talk about going nowhere. Like that book goes nowhere. It's about I can't even really remember much of it. That's how what little impact it had.
Has she done much more than after that?
I don't think so. I think that was the second.
She would have made a bundle on this.
Well, she's probably still making a bundle on that.
Yeah. This is still, yeah.
Just look at her. Look at that author photo. Seriously, couldn't they?
That sums the book up.
I'm sorry. You don't read that as a performance. That author photo in tying in with the book.
Oh, maybe, but. It only. Oh yeah, all right.
I love that.
Like you said, POMO.
The little friend, by the way.
The little friend.
Yeah,
the little friend.
It actually says here in my copy.
Yeah. I didn't like it at all, and I really tried to like it, and it was just long and boring and tedious.
So John probably shouldn't read it then, because I know he was about to run out. And go.
This is my fascination because you're describing just what I felt about The Secret History. You think so is it that, in fact, she was always writing those books? It's just somehow
it's a very different book. I mean, it's not about a group of people. It's not about
what was the
teenagers.
Secret.
The Secret History?
What was the secret?
There's no secret. It's The Secret History. It's not a history of the secret. It's like it's what hasn't been told about this.
Generation X.
Okay. So my choice.
So
is,
we're going to move on
for almost the same reasons. Kirsten chose hers. This is a book I read in 91. When I read this book, I had that amazing revelation of this is me. This is the first book I've ever read that really is me. Yeah. The plot, such as is, Andy and his friends Dag, or probably Darg, and Claire. Live in Palm Springs. They're very Gen X-y, hence the name. And they know about history. Everything's a story. Everything's where you fit and stuff. They're all kind of a bit aimless because they don't know if they'll ever achieve anything in their lives.
Aimless.
But they tell stories. They're constantly telling stories about. Yeah, and the first time I read this book, I really had that thing of about people talk Catcher in the Rye when they're kids and stuff, and I never had that. And this one, I went, oh my god, this is me and the people I know, and this is where we are in history. And I've read it a couple of times, since then. I love Douglas Copeland. I've read everything. In fact, when I was trying to tune through Secret History, I read three other books while trying to read Secret History, including a Douglas Copeland I didn't even know existed. It turned out it was a radio drama, which was then published. But going back and reading it, and I now blame Donna Tartt.
Oh,
because reading it after, I thought, oh, just grow up. I had no time for these people. They're white people problems.
That's true.
But and I was actually really angry because this book, which I had loved, had now just been destroyed by Donna Tartt.
I don't think it was Donna Tartt. I think it was maybe those 20 years.
it could be that, but I'm still reckoning Donna Tartt's a lot to do. Look, I actually still am happy, though, when I got to the end of the book, I actually had found my love for them again in a slightly different way. And because there are bits and pieces in this book that I still go. I mean, is that thing too?
The individual stories are cute. Like the Texas Homer story and all that. Some individual stories are fucking hilarious.
The structure is fun. Like the storytelling structure of it is fun when they're telling each other stories. And the stories are obviously allegorical and tell you something about the characters without being literal.
So meaningful.
Well, but it
is. Oh, we're telling a story about a rabbit in the desert who finds a basket of kittens. It's like,
But they tend to be funny and they're sardonic and very ironic because it was the early 90s and
so
that's what people were doing. Yeah, it's layers and layers of irony. The other thing the book was famous for was these definitions, and I must admit, those.
They shat me no end.
Right, I was going to say they were, because they don't.
Look, David Foster Wallace pulls it off really well, Footnotes in Infinite Jest, which I've read. But this shat me because they break up the reading, but not in a good way.
They're just along the bottoms of pages.
It's funny because in my edition.
You've got the big sort of full-scale
version.
They're
in the margin.
I think yours made I'm sure there was a different version first, and that might be the big scale one might actually be
which
what
kind of and they've got little comic done. Things.
Yeah,
and
they're
stuff.
In this as well, but
as a okay. Yeah, they're all in smaller versions. But
I think this layout probably suits the book better.
It does, and I think that may have been the original layout. But even though I did have that thing of, I still love some of the definitions. They still
really
they
like, all shat me. They all felt like bad jokes.
Well, it's that thing that this is the thing that when I read it, living in these share houses and recognizing this stuff. That
see, I never
thing.
Experienced that. But okay,
So this one, in particular, recreational slumming, which it says the practice of participating in recreational activities of a class one perceives as lower than one's own. And there's a quote: Karen, Donald, let's go bowling tonight, and don't worry about shoes. Apparently, you can rent them.
And I it's funny
because I read that and went, oh my god, that's exactly what we do. And there's another bit later about nutritional slumming.
That's the bit I was about to read.
Oh, go on. Yeah, so read that one.
That was one of the few that I laughed out loud for. Nutritional slumming is food whose enjoyment stems not from flavour but from a complex mixture of class connotations, nostalgia signals, and packaging semiotics. For example, Katie and I bought this tub of multi-whip instead of real whipped cream because we thought petroleum distillate whip topping seemed like the sort of food that Air Force wives stationed in Pensacola back in the early 60s would feed their husbands to celebrate a career promotion.
And that's still exactly the kind of shopping I do. That's what I mean. That's what I go, oh my God, I really recognize.
Are you trying to say 20 years later you haven't grown up?
I obviously in some ways, but I would still do that. I would buy a product because it has in my head a complex bunch of signifiers to some other.
But the three of us are Generation X. You know, aren't we? The three of us are Generation X. And I didn't relate to these people.
You never lived in a share house.
I had but one other roommate, not the share house.
Right,
yeah. It's more than one, isn't
plus
it?
Plus, your other roommate wasn't a Gen Xer.
Mm-hmm. Who?
Ori.
Okay. It was before him. There was another person.
Oh, okay.
Who was a Gen Xer?
Okay. I hadn't.
But it wasn't in the 90s, though. It was
this
in the
is 2000s. The first time I'd read this book.
Mm-hmm. Have you read any of his other stuff?
I think I've read Microsurfs and I can't remember.
I own JPod and Microsurfs, but mm-hmm. I haven't read them.
But yeah, this was the first time I'd read it, and I hated it as much as you hated the sequel.
Because
on every page, I just wanted to slap them and say, "Grow the fuck up!"
Especially Dag. So, Dag just shits me.
Dag is weird. I don't even remember
Dag's
him
just
being
just mentally
quite
unbalanced.
So, yeah.
Whereas the other, I mean, what's his name? So
Andy.
Oh God, Andy and Claire.
And Claire runs off for the New York guy who obviously doesn't like her. And
I mean, poor little petals. It's like, oh, that's terrible. You have to go down to San Francisco. Or where were they?
So they're in Palm Springs.
Palm Springs and live in your little... They weren't even fucking share housing. They've got their own bungalows. Oh, you poor things. Oh, God, I hated them.
I will say that it's still an important historical novel.
Why is it? What did this do historically?
Well, a whole bunch of stuff like even the phrase Generation X comes from this, basically.
But it doesn't.
It was popularised.
That's what I'm saying. Popularised. I know you were shouting before we even started. You can't quite see the difference between
who's the band? 1976? Billy Idol.
But popularised the idea of Generation X. Okay. There's also a whole bunch of words in here. Things like option paralysis, McJobs. There's a whole bunch of phrases.
Oh, McJobs comes from
this.
Yeah.
I think they probably all existed beforehand, but he popularized, he brought them into, and a lot of this I do read and I still recognize it, but it's funny how that kind of, 90s angst now just seems so kind of weirdly.
Well, it is, it's alien now. That whole decade is alien because, two planes hadn't smacked into the Twin Towers.
Well, that's one of the interesting things about this. He talks about how we're living in a time in which history has ended, which did feel quite right in the 90s.
Correct.
It felt like everything had been done.
Chuck Palahniuk is all about that in the 90s, that history's ended, IKEA furniture, and we're all fucked.
Also,
I mean, that's
everyone knows everything at this point.
Yes.
We grew up in that. We grew up in, even as writers, it was filmmakers in particular. If you were a filmmaker in the 70s, you had maybe seen some classic films if they showed up on television or if a revival house had showed them. By the time the 90s had come around, you could get anything you wanted on video. It was still video, but history was becoming
accessible to the masses?
Well, not accessible. No, it was becoming actually slightly crushing. I think history actually became depressing in the 90s because suddenly anything you wanted to create not only had been done before and probably better, but you could get a copy of it. Whereas up to that point, people made their own thing trying to do that and had that freedom. Look, my theory, and that's what these books were kind of about, going, anything we want to do has actually already been done and is now obtainable. And now in the world of the internet, of course, that's even more true than it ever was. We can get anything we want.
Yeah.
But this was the first time I think it had become clear to these people that, yeah, your record probably still won't be as good as the Stooges. You know, it's that thing of everything is available.
Yeah, okay.
And that's kind of partly what these characters are reacting against. And that I remember, I just not necessarily interested in.
It's so very arrogant, though, isn't it? To declare, this is it, we've done everything, we can never... I mean, it's real arrogance. And I know when I was studying history at university, about the time this book was published, there was a very famous book which was published at the time called The End of History.
Fakir Sharma.
Yeah, that's the guy.
Yeah.
Which did posit essentially that the grand historical narrative...
We were all taught that in first year uni.
...is over. Who wrote that grand historical narrative? I mean, that was never history. That's just a narrative we put onto stuff that happened. And now we look at it in different ways. So, you know, if it's the end of history in terms of the way we look at narratives of the past and privilege some information over others and some people over others, then I say that's a damn good thing.
Well, it's just that the book of his I read while, you know, churning through Donna Tartt was... And I annoyingly forgotten the name of. It was actually just in the library when I had to get something else. But it was written as a radio thing for a Canadian... station. He actually has this belief in there that people have stopped seeing their story, their lives as stories.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of interesting, in some ways it's a reference back to Generation X, that he's kind of saying the older characters believe their lives would be a story and we're trying to get one with a happy ending. The younger characters don't really view their lives like that anymore. It's moments and instances.
Yeah, vignettes.
And vignettes, yeah. And in fact, in some ways he's saying they're actually happier because they're not worried that their story's gone wrong or their story has...
Is going down the wrong narrative path.
Exactly.
And
yeah.
It's all about leaving a legacy, and they don't care because they don't require the narrative anymore.
Yeah, and that's quite interesting because this book is all about a narrative. It's all about Generation X is people wanting to have the right story, and these guys have almost opted out because they're just too frightened that they're going to have the wrong one.
Yeah.
Whereas he's saying in this new one, and it's actually weird because the newest book, the name of which I forget, he actually has someone quote Generation X, which is kind of weird. Someone actually says, there's a line there about how nothing very, very good or very, very bad ever lasts for very, very long.
Yeah.
And that was the thing, so as I got through this, because I started off just really hating these guys and finding them really annoying, but about halfway through I did click into some of it.
When Dag burns the car.
No, that's just ridiculous. And then
tries to blame
them. Yeah, yeah. But a homeless man dies. Hooray!
Now we won't get in trouble.
Yeah, but look, leaving aside that, there is still some real beauty in this book. There are some lovely moments. Some of the stories themselves are really interesting. There's some really... It's just funny that it's so now a period piece.
Yeah, it is.
It's become historical. Both this and the Donna Tartt have become historical artifacts.
Microsurfs is fascinating for that very reason. The Microsurfs is now completely
I read that a long time ago too.
Yeah, because it was all about high-tech computing stuff.
Which would be really funny to read now.
Well, because I heard it a few years later. I listened to the audiobook version of that read by... Chandler from Friends.
Oh, wow. I thought you were going to say Margot Lidbell for a second.
Would just be even more awesomely kind of 90s now. And I don't mind the fact that, you know...
Actually, was it actually Chandler from Friends reading
no,
as opposed to Matthew
good.
Perry?
Yeah,
that would be awesome.
That would be quite awesome. But I don't... I do think, you know, Copeland is an author who writes in the moment, in the historical moment. That's interesting, you know, and his books become...
Well, no, but it's important because as the years go on, we will look back. This will stay in the canon. Mm. I mean, I don't know if it's been put in the canon.
It's
kind of a superficial thing,
though, isn't it? Which I guess is why...
The book?
Yeah, which is why it becomes... I mean...
But don't you think that's definitely, to me, still a view into the mindset of the 90s?
That's what I mean. The 90s.
You know, that pretty much, to me, is... Yeah, how people were...
No.
Look, their biggest war was Bosnia versus Serbia. I mean, come on. That's the 90s.
To me, this is the same world that Nirvana and that's
this is
and
this
the slacker
is a
films
particular
and...
demographic of people living in the 90s. This isn't the 90s, and that's what I think is the problem because it becomes this superficial thing where people go, "Well, that's the 90s."
The 90s when is where it the clearly middle class isn't. Got bored of itself. Really, that's what happened. And it's only until we got 9/11 that things perked up again in terms of
hurrah.
Well, no, I mean that.
No. I actually agree though what you're saying though. I think there is a point that this is a weird point where people had money and safety and realized that they were bored.
That's what Fight Club's about. That's why I mentioned Panyuk, because he talks about it as well. You know, we're bored of ourselves. Yeah, we don't know what to do with it.
Very much out of the
We don't know what to do with ourselves. We've got no water fight. We've got no Vietnam. We're all rooted. We're all going to spend our money on IKEA and stare off into the distance. We're all fucked. Then 9/11 happens. We go, oh shit, now we've got something to fight for. I mean, Occupy Wall Street, which is happening right now, did not happen in the 1990s. No. I don't know if there was even an equivalent of that.
No,
because I it was a thing of everyone was just so depressed by everything being terrible that they just made ironic jokes about it.
Correct.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that's the weird thing. Like, both Seinfeld, Nirvana, you know, Fight Club, it's all that same world that this is all from. And so I know there's all American
references. And a very postmodern thing. It's all the POMO.
It's incredibly postmodern. Yeah,
we've fucking moved on past that. Postmodern's all right when, you
which
know,
is a really
there
nice
are terrorists
sort of white
up.
Upper middle class yeah, way of looking
that.
At the
I
world.
Know that. I know that. There
but this is what I'm saying. But this is what I'm saying. I guess the problem, not the problem I have with that book, the problem I have with books like that being stamped as, well, this is a snapshot of a generation. It's like, no, it's not. It's a snapshot of a small part of a generation who, you know.
You're right, because you still had terrible tragedies going on in Africa in the 90s. I mean, I know all that Cambodia, you know, and in America, Ethiopia. I understand that.
You know,
Somalia happened in the 90s. I know what you're saying, but
and this is the problem, because you get, oh, this is the 90s. It's so clearly not the 90s. It's so clearly
is the 90s.
No, it's a particular demographic that lived in the 90s that had a very loud voice and chose not to say anything much.
No, okay. Sorry, can I say it's the Western 90s. It's an artifact of the Western world in the 90s. I'm not talking about it is.
I kind of think it is.
I found it so annoying.
And that's another thing. So I think a lot of Australians, a lot of Americans, a lot of English people, certainly around that time, read this. And, you know, I read it and went, oh my God, that is the life I'm living in now. Like, it really seemed very reflective.
The Birmingham book, the falafel one, that's also about share housing. That was written in the 90s too, wasn't it?
That's a little bit later, isn't it?
Later than this.
I don't think it's in the 2000s.
No,
that's why I do find it fascinating, because I can open this up now and I can get an insight into, I mean, maybe it's the younger me, but I get an insight into certainly what people I knew were feeling.
Mm.
You know, and yeah, and now I'm annoyed with them and think, oh, for God's sake, get over yourself. But it's kind of interesting that it does seem to.
Yeah. I remember mostly being just really annoyed by media, because, yeah, I mean, I'm Generation X. And
she's a year older than me.
I remember being really, really annoyed by all of the Gen X stuff that was in the media. And it's like, well, that's not me, and that's not the people I know.
Well, that's the same with the Gen Y thing as well. I get really annoyed about anything about Gen Y, because it's all just young people do some stuff. It's
exactly. They all do that. To now have
they always did. It's not, young people seem to take drugs and don't like their elders.
So like Schoolies Week. I mean, I went on Schoolies Week. It was fucked then as well. I'm Gen X, so it's not changed.
No, exactly. But that's the thing. And so I remember living in that. I didn't read the book then, but I remember living in that time and just being really, really annoyed by all of the stereotypes and the media hype about Gen X and all that kind of stuff. And now this book is kind of canonized as that snapshot. And it's like, well, but I was that generation. I am that generation. And
it is an artifact. Live with it. It is 100 years from now.
I'm not saying it isn't an artifact. I'm saying I have a problem with it being an artifact.
You know that episode in the Goodies when they get caught in the building and then the future Goodies come and get them out. And they're just a skeletons. One of them will be holding a copy of Generation X.
I think human beings.
And that will be the history.
No,
the Goodies
exactly.
Is remembered
exactly.
For.
I'm saying, and I think human beings are inherently lazy, and we like to go for the quick thing. So that's the 90s, and that's what this is, and we do not like to hold complexity in our head. And I find that very annoying about people, but it's what we do. I do it too. Everyone does it. Our brains aren't big enough to hold complex notions for any length of time.
What about the skeletons and the bits and the Goodies? That was funny.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to undercut your very, very insightful, meaningful comment. Sorry, no, that.
But reading this book now, I just fucking hate it.
I did like the individual stories. There was the Japanese thing about the old Japanese man who takes, I think it's Andy, into this room to show him this.
Story.
It was with a picture baseball. Of Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, yes, yeah, Marilyn Monroe. And Andy's going, I want to get out of here. And runs off. That actually is a really good piece of writing. And there's bits of that throughout the book. Which I
as
really
it went
liked.
On, I did get back into it. I think there's certainly – there's stuff of interest, but you have to read it as a
– What's all the numbers at the back? What was that about?
There's this weird thing where there's the facts at the back about it's comparing things from the 70s to the late 80s, basically. I think it's to show a generational change. And that's what I mean, how of its moment this is.
Yeah.
I was also going to point out, it's 208 pages, so it is less than half the length of The Secret History by Donna Tartt. So,
in your mind, that's all about the stuff around the house, and the snow's coming through the hole.
Pointing out that no matter how annoyed Kirsten could have been reading this, I was 2.5 times more annoyed by reading her.
That's a fair cop. I'd really love to have some of these questions and demographics asked now, like another 12 years.
Yeah,
I think that would be really cool.
It's fascinating because they're all stuff like percentage of income required for a down payment on a first home in 67 was 22%, in 87 was 32%.
Yeah, you know what it is now? It's over 100%.
Right, yeah.
Oh, sorry, not the down payment, sorry. Mortgage repayments is over 100%. Because you now need two people working in a house, basically,
yes,
to get a house.
A 1990 quote from Rolling Stone, percentage of US budget spent on the elderly, 30%, on education, 2%. And I think that would be interesting to see what that's changed as well. But that doesn't mean this is so of a moment. And that was kind of fascinating to realize it was so of a moment.
As much as it annoyed me, I'm very happy you recommended it because I wouldn't have read it otherwise.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm happy I read it. It was annoying. They're all annoying. Richard, kind of at the end, you think you get the idea that he may be ready to move out of that bungalow?
You mean Andy?
So Andy.
Yeah. He's moving on. I think there's a moment of hope at the end, which is,
he might be about
not earned,
to.
Yeah, I mean, the homeless man's now dead, so they're
out. So everything's good.
Yeah.
Homeless man, farmers in Vermont.
Yeah.
Are we at 2 hours yet? We cracked 2 hours?
No, we're only at an hour and a half.
Really?
Really.
Even with Johnny.
And that's it. That's the three books. We're done.
That is the three books.
Well.
That's awesome.
Really? You should want to spread it another 25
minutes.
So
we've got, I guess we can recommend all three depending on who you agree with.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think we all agree that the Room has problems.
Room would be a goer.
Yeah, Room. Yeah. Probably all like Room.
Yeah.
Mind you, it was a book which doesn't polarise people.
No, it's a book that none of us are saying is absolutely brilliant.
I know.
We're just saying, it's all right.
I'd just like to point out that I was the moderating voice in this whole podcast.
You kind of were.
You were the two rants on either side. Usually I'm the ranty, but I just want to say I was the middle between two extremes. Two gorgeous extremes, I might say.
Very handsome. Thank you.
I haven't mentioned, John, that you're wearing a tie to this podcast.
Yeah, well, one always dresses for a podcast. Yes. I can't believe you don't dress for a podcast.
I don't.
Box cutters we do in Denison.
What do you mean he is dressed?
Yeah. Yeah.
You should see him when we're recording at home.
I do not get my ghoulies out. Oh, you do.
I do not anymore.
Are we wrapping up or did you want to say something else? Are you wrapping up?
I don't know.
No, you can wrap up. You do.
Do you normally have cats? I forgot to ask if either of you are allergic.
I have
cats.
A cat.
Okay.
I have a cat. Because she sometimes comes.
It's a little bit late now.
She doesn't really sit on the table,
though. Yeah.
This is really cool.
Yeah. That rash on my face, that's not through the cat.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
It's just natural.
No, that's just what happens.
That's from the stick from the microphone.
That's the visual cat, and this one's the interactive cat.
Yeah.
She's like the Gong Li of cats. She just looks out of windows and looks grumpy, whereas this one you can actually play with.
Ah, I see. Okay. So I'm going to say, if you have any feedback for the podcast,
and there should be a lot for a John Richards podcast, guest starring John Richards. There should be plenty of feedback because he's a lot of racist things in this podcast.
Oh, so racist.
Very racist. Yeah. Oh, sorry. Keep going, Kirsten. Sorry.
As I was saying, if you'd like to send feedback to the podcast, we'd love to hear from you. You can comment at the website, which is writerandcritic.podbean.com. You can send us email to writerandcritic@gmail.com. Or you can leave us the rating of your choice.
5 stars.
On iTunes.
Has anyone ever gone to iTunes and given like 2 stars? Has anyone done
that? Yeah, our box cutters, we got a 1-star review because we didn't like Misfits.
Oh.
Bullshit.
Yeah, no, someone actually, I only know this because Josh got really upset about it. But basically, it was a review we gave and we just disagreed with whoever's opinion it was. So he automatically gave us a 1-star, regardless of what our reasoning or, we show our working.
Josh is right. Josh is right to be upset. I agree with Josh. You do not go to iTunes and put 1-star in. That's what cocks do. If you don't like it, why are you listening to it? Why are you downloading it?
We don't need to bring poultry into this.
We should. All the time.
So next month is going to be December. And we're kind of pursuing the literary theme of the podcast, I guess, through to the end of the year.
For our second episode of season 2.
So in December, I recommended a book called We Need to Talk About Kevin by Lionel Shriver, which I really like. Spoiler.
And is in cinemas now.
And yeah, there is a movie Tilda Swinton, who's my favourite actor in the whole world. So I can't wait to see that movie, which I believe is actually really good. And I've seen like the sneak previews of scenes. It just looks really close to the book. So very excited about that one. And Ian has recommended The Tiger's Wife by Taya Obrett. And both of these books were Orange Prize winners
which is the link,
the tenuous link.
Yeah.
Because Ian actually recommended Tiger's Wife and went, oh, I could do, we should talk about Kevin, because it also won. And for those who don't know, the Orange Prize is one of the UK's most prestigious literary prizes, annually awarded to a female author of any nationality for a novel. But it has to be written in English and published in the UK the previous year.
Is Lionel Shriver a woman?
Lionel Shriver's a woman.
I did not know.
Yes,
she is. I've read that book. I was unaware.
Yes. So that's next month, Orange Prize wins.
I didn't know Evelyn Waugh was a man.
I know.
Yeah.
All right.
You didn't have to say I let that go when you said
it. Oh, I'm letting it out.
I had that with the Gershwins. I assumed they were husband and wife.
Are they?
No, George and Ira. No, they're both men.
Oh, Ira's a of course, a good Jewish boy's name. Yeah,
they're a gay married couple.
Yeah.
So you've now done a full podcast with me, Josh and I. I should let it go. What? I just need
let
to
let it
say.
Go.
All yeah. right.
Yeah, you two all get right. a room.
There is a sexual magnetism to Josh that I find magnetizing.
Plus, he's got curly hair.
He does, but he's shorter now than he nice used to be. Curly hair. He's got a bit bald.
I actually think he's better looking than you.
No.
And funnier, too.
Really?
Yeah.
I'll tell you what it is. I've got another 5 minutes. I think on the spot, the wit, he's better. I think I stumble a little bit more. But for the protracted point of view, you always got to go to the Mond.
You're far rantier. If I wanted to rant, I would be going to you.
I don't think he squeals.
Well, I call it a protracted point of view. Mm. You call it a rant. He doesn't squeal, no. He doesn't get water squirted at him either, or a stick stuck up his ass.
I didn't squirt water at you, and I did not have any stick tonight.
No, thanks. All right, anyway, so...
didn't peg.
We should mention, just before we go, Nina Allen, I think, while you were away in World Fantasy, wrote some feedback saying how much she liked our Rob Shearman / Lisa Hannett podcast.
Oh, okay.
Because I was going to mention Rob Shearman, because you've got the pseudo-boyfriend that I want to be as my pseudo-boyfriend.
He's not.
I'm so jealous of your pseudo-boyfriend.
He's mine only.
I know. Right? I know. I'm so jealous.
Come March, because I'm going to be in Adelaide in 5th of 6th of March or whatever it is. That weekend.
First weekend of March.
Adelaide Writers Festival. I'll be interviewing Rob on... We'll be doing the Dalek commentary.
Oh, awesome.
It'll be cool.
Just 5 of that. Yeah, that'll be fun.
Yeah, it's only $400.
An excuse to go to Adelaide. Who would have thought that would ever happen?
No.
I've never been. Do you know I've never been to Adelaide?
Really?
Yeah, it's first time. Rundle Mall. Never been there.
Really good wine.
Great. Okay, so...
That's it.
On that note, that's it for me.
And
bye-bye.
That's it for me.
And John, it's been... Really, before you say
it's been awesome.
You are brilliant.
Wow. Thank you.
You managed
watch
to
my show if it ever goes to
air. No,
hopefully,
certainly will.
February 2012, we're hoping.
Mayan prophecy,
notwithstanding.
I think the Mayan prophecy comes later in the year, doesn't it? So you should still get a screening.
If you know anybody who actually has a people meter or is any kind of registered ratings person, do break into their house and force them to watch
my
show.
I did know someone, but he just had it taken away a month ago. His tenure... contract, whatever they call it, ended, and they came and took it away.
The Bazura Project's ratings probably doubled 1 week, and I think one more person switched on. That's their guess.
Well, John, we'd love to have you back again, possibly next year. We can do it next year.
As long as I don't have to read The Secret History by Donna Tartt.
No.
No, we won't be recapping that one.
We'll just make it 3 Terrence Dix novelisations, because I know we'll be into that. All right.
Maybe you can have that by yourself.
Okay, whatever.
I'll take a day off.
We love you, John. Well, you've been fantastic. And Kirsten, you've been wonderful. And I've been moderate. So it's been really the oldest podcast of them all.
I do apologise if my voice dropped in and out a little back then, because I know my sound was a bit low at one point. So thanks for bearing with me, listeners. Also, Ian's just overbearing. Good night.
I complimented her. Bye.
What? I didn't realize this was meant to be a science fiction one.